This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Listeners of the Mad Scientist Podcast, have I got a deal for you? If you follow the social media of the show, you know that I'm a pretty hairy dude, which is why I was really excited when Manscaped reached out and offered to send us some free goodies to see if we wanted to promote it to you all. I've got to say, right now, this is probably one of the best products I have ever bought for myself. Not only is it waterproof, but it also makes sure that you don't get any nicks or things in areas that you probably don't want cuts, to be frank. That's why I'm so happy to say that support for the Mad Scientist Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Their products are precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped's performance package is the ultimate in men's hygiene bundles. Join over 6 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with its exclusive offer for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code MADSCIENCE. That's MADSCIENCE at manscaped.com. If my math is correct, that's about 12 million balls. What a great time! Again, get 20% off and free shipping with the code MADSCIENCE at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com using the code MADSCIENCE. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. All right.
Nice.
Okay. The judgment of God sent the calamity to teach the Irish a lesson. That calamity must not be too much mitigated. The real evil with which we have to contend is not the physical evil of the famine, but the moral evil of the selfish, perverse, and turbulent character of the people. Sir Charles Trevelyan, head of administration for famine relief during the Great Irish Famine.
Do you notice how it's always easiest to say that it's teaching somebody else a lesson when things are going poorly?
That's the guy in charge of relief.
He seems like a nice guy.
What a fucking asshole. Dear listeners, welcome to the Mad Scientist Podcast. We're here on Irish Famine Part 3. I can't believe, I just cannot get over this guy. He's like a Captain Planet villain level of evil. He's just insane. It's crazy.
Well, the level of like delusion too, like I said, it's like, it's always sort of this act of God when horrible things are happening to other people. It's their judgment, right? But when it's actually happening to you, you never are like, oh yeah, we really asked for this. Nobody says that.
God punishes other people. He only tests you, though.
He tests, right, exactly, exactly. And it's ridiculous. Always something external. It's still the Irish's fault.
Good God. All right, so... Dear listeners, last episode we ended up on the fact that, you know, famine starts up here in 1845. And the government basically, at the time, run by Sir Robert Peel, essentially sort of tries to say, like, listen, the Irish are always complaining about something. We don't know how bad this is actually going to be. Let's not worry about it just yet. And in this episode... We're going to talk about how they should have been worrying about it before. They should have done anything to stop it during, and how it's just, oh God, Jake, just roll the tape. It's terrible. Oh, all right, Marie.
Maybe we should also very quickly, you know, give a shout out to our UK listeners, since we had defamed their monarchy in previous episodes and recent events, you know, might, you know, soften that a bit.
Sorry for your queen.
Sorry for your loss. Sorry for your country's loss. That's pretty diplomatic, actually.
That's very diplomatic, Marie. All right, we're moving past it. So the famine starts off. Well, no. You know what, Marie? Let's get into it. I don't understand.
We were so close. Okay.
We were so close. So okay. The one weird thing about this, okay. And we're actually gonna get into this with a famine too.
Okay.
It's a really weird. The UK government of the time, and I even think still today, and I'm not from the UK, right? I can't. Mm-hmm. This is just an outsider looking in, right? Mm-hmm. The UK is very, I think, they're very set on history and on kind of decorum and on, you know, things that happened in the past are considered still sort of like, it's a very like Game of Thrones way of looking at the world. Do you know what I mean? Like for some reason the queen matters in the modern day outside of just being kind of like a living museum artifact you have that tourists come and to gawk at.
Well, and I'll argue for the sake of argument, I will argue pro monarchy, I guess. It's the closest way of saying this. I think that we as Americans perhaps don't understand or appreciate how much of a cultural institution the idea of the queen and the throne and the monarchy serve for British identity. I just don't think, I don't think it's necessarily in our vocabulary. Like there's nothing, I would argue in America, there's very few things that we would identify as closely with as some of the British population identify with and kind of sympathize and hold, you know, reverence for the monarchy. I mean, can you think of something that has such a, overreach is probably a bad word, but has such a reach into your daily life or into your general existence that you would literally say, God save the queen.
I mean, I've been to Graceland, Marie.
You haven't? I mean, Elvis
I've been
is.
To Dollywood. Like, I've been to Nashville. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. Like, I understand the idea of, like, the king. You know what I mean? But, like, I get what you're saying. It's sort of how, you know, I think it's always weird whenever you go to like a museum and you see like, you know, you go to like Monticello or whatever, George Washington's
Colonial Williamsburg
or whatever. And then it's like, you know, and this guy here chewing tobacco and drinking whiskey. This is George Washington's great, 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 great grandson. And you're like, who gives a shit? Cool. You know what I mean? Like that, like, you know, I always think it's weird when it's like, you know, oh, and this is still like the fan, like somehow that the idea of like in America, the idea of, I think, generational wealth have that, of course. Right. I mean, you know,
we're getting like, good at that. Yeah.
We're getting real good at that, you know, but I think we sort of tend to believe. Like, I don't know, in America, I almost think, like, in America, we think of our, like, rich families as being, like, trashy as shit. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, does anyone think Paris Hilton is a smart person? Or, like, it should be a leader, really?
Well, yeah, no.
Or, like, Kim Kardashian, or, like, you know, Warren Buffett. Like, you know, like, I think, you know, we have kind of it's a weird difference, whereas in the UK, I think, it's this idea of, like, you know, oh, well, they're rich, they go to great schools, they go to, like, I mean, we have that too. We just don't call it.
I don't know if it's so much wealth. I mean, I think wealth has a huge part of it, or the idea of wealth has a huge part of it. I just think, like, the turning point in my head where I was like, we really don't get this, was when they were talking about the queue to view the Queen's casket.
Fucking crazy.
The queue not only was inherently British, right, in that it was very well organized. You know, there was like placards and, you know, everyone had wristbands and there were rules, but it went on for 5 miles. Like you couldn't, it was insane how long it was that you wouldn't be able to, that people, you know, you wouldn't be able to leave the line. You couldn't, you know, you were sleeping in that, like we'll do that for sporting events, for certain things. And that's, you know, or, you know, big events for certain things. But like that type of reverence for a person, I just don't necessarily, I was like, I just don't get it. And I think that that's it. Like, I'm an American and I don't get it. But that doesn't mean that, like, that, you know, clearly there's a lot of people that still have a lot of really strong feelings for it.
Absolutely. I mean, there is, I think, and honestly, listeners, you're going to get a lot of that through this episode of just kind of stuff that I think as Americans on the outside, we just don't get about this. You know what I mean? Really.
Not to say that, like...
Like, you can't, I, like, you yeah. can't get it. Like, I under, you know, again, to in a serious note, I understand, you know, this person has been in an institution. She's been around this, in, you know, basically for most of our listeners' entire lives.
Yeah. Longest living monarch. That's amazing, you know, considering that, you know, they got pretty good at killing off monarchs.
They did. They got real good at it. And, you know, I mean, at the same time, it's a very complicated story, though, because, you know, one country's, you know, I mean, inevitably, one country's beloved ruler is another mm-hmm. country's, like, Grim Reaper. You know, I mean, it's...
Yes.
Inevitably, yeah. those yeah. sorts of things happen here, and yeah. especially for a country that's had such a storied history of conquering and subjugating other countries, Agreed. It gets very complicated.
Agreed.
But, you know, this idea, though, of, like, British decorum or reverence for... old families, and this almost like this idea that like the genetic stock of these families make them better than other people, you know, that's the part I don't really understand, right? It's almost like, again, in Game of Thrones, the Targaryens, right? This idea that like the blood of High Valyria mm-hmm. makes them fit to rule, right? Like, you know, that I think, and I don't think that there's, it's almost like the British public just sort of like pretend like that's still okay. Like, I don't think anyone actually believes that, right? No one actually believes that the monarch, the queen or the prince or any of these fucking people, I don't think anyone actually thinks they matter, do they?
Oh, well, that's the thing I just don't think we know, because clearly they do think they matter. Clearly there's a huge part of that population that have reverence for the monarchy and for right. whatever it represents to them. And I'd be kind of curious to hear from our, you know, our British UK, you know, listeners, like, what does that entail? Like, I know that it is impossible to excuse them from the empire and from, you know, the travesties that they brought on other people and that have still not answered to, but it still seems like there is, you know, those things coexist, right? There's people out there that are very adamantly anti-monarchy, but then there's, again, these people queuing up from all walks of life in the UK to see the casket, which that's where I was like, I just don't get it. I don't know what it is.
All right. Now, listen, we got to talk about the 5-mile queue in the room. We are sorry for those who liked the queen and cared about the royal family and everything else. We're sorry that your queen died. It sucks whenever anyone dies. We also, though, understand that there's a lot of people who think, awesome. She's, you know what I mean? Like, whatever. Like, the monarchy is such a, I don't know. I don't know what to say about it.
I just think, I kind of feel like the two things can exist, right? Like, I can say that as an American, I don't understand, and I have a limited opinion about the monarchy because I'm an American.
Yes. All right. We're okay. Good. We're
you know,
good.
To me, it's like, that's okay. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. We're going to keep going.
About that?
I do. You ready, Marie? Okay.
Yes, I do.
All right. Okay. So back to the famine.
Yes. Back to famine.
Last time we talked about how the potato crop starts to show signs of real issue in the year 1845, right before the winter starts coming in, so right in the autumn. And at the time, there are really three camps of biologists who had different thoughts about what the cause of the blight was. And they had three different names. There were the botanists, the degenerate, there were three camps. The botanists, and they thought it was all due to bad weather. The degenerists, who thought that it had to do with, like, you keep growing the same crop again and again and again, and eventually the soil is just going to turn to crap. And then there were the fungalists, who thought that this was probably caused by some kind of fungus or something. And of course, we know that they're the ones that were ultimately correct.
The fungalists almost always get it right.
Almost always get it right.
They really do. Now,
again, at this time, though, like, understanding what caused the blight almost didn't really matter, because there's no way you were going to control this thing. You know, once the blight got to Ireland and once the blight took hold, there was really nothing you could do. And so, at least in terms of stopping the blight, or like, at least in terms of stopping the biology of what caused the blight to happen, right? There was really nothing you could do. Now, again, at the time here, Sir Robert Peel is the Prime Minister of the UK. He had previously been told by Sir Graham James, the Home Secretary, that the Irish exaggeration of the famine was coming in. They were being told it was way worse than it really was, and they had to wait until October to determine if anything really was wrong. And by October, they start getting reports that, like, at least half the potato crop is completely gone.
So it is as bad.
And it is worse. It is worse than what was being reported. And so the government finally is spurred into action by mid-October. Now, the thing that Robert Peel becomes best known for, really, at least in terms of kind of domestic policy, I guess, he's also considered the father of British policing. He starts really like a municipal police force. But he's particularly known for the repeal of what are known as the Corn Laws. And his first idea when it comes to famine relief is, we got to get rid of these Corn Laws. The Corn Laws are sort of a weird, like, they're a holdover from the days of mercantilism. So remember, this is an economy that is slowly becoming capitalist, but is still in kind of a late mercantilism period. And mercantilism as an economic system is a economic system based on trade, right? It's based on merchants and the trade of goods across the ocean. Now, the idea of the Corn Laws, it's basically economic manipulation by the government in favor of local grain growers. So a corn at that time is known as, it's any cereal grain, right? So barley, wheat, oat, corn, you know, anything that we consider like a grain, you know? The way that the Corn Laws worked, they basically were different government interventions to keep the price of UK grains high while artificially increasing the price of imported grains from countries where it should have been cheaper. Yeah, so they're tariffs, really. They're kind of tariffs or taxes or whatever you want to call them. But so there are things like high tariffs on imported grain from the Americas, high taxes on importation itself. So even if you were just the person bringing it in, and not the person who had made the grain, you were still paying that high tax. And sometimes even things as extreme as setting minimum prices below which it was illegal to sell grain at all. So, like, corn was always going to be, you know, like a half pence a pound or whatever, right? So they artificially created prices. And again, the original idea here was, we're going to keep the price of UK grain high as kind of protectionism for their own economy. The problem was, this is a time where the number of people now living in places where they were not farming, they were manufacturers, they were technologists, they were scientists, they were whatever. Other things besides farming, right? As they start moving into a capitalist industrialized economy, the number of farmers drops way down. Yeah. I mean, it's what happened in the United States, right?
Yeah.
We became an industrialized economy. All of our farming, or a lot of our farming, gets sent over to other countries. And so now we import way more food than we did when we were a main farming economy. And so The issue, though, here at the time, right, so the UK economy at the time, this means that, again, the primary beneficiaries of the corn laws staying in place were rich landowning families.
What?
Because they could continue to reap these high rewards from a economic activity that was very quickly becoming outdated by just importing grain from other countries.
So I have a quick question.
Go ahead.
In our past episode, we talked about extraction economy.
Yes.
So can you kind of tie the two things together?
Well, that's the thing. And a lot of the part of, I think, what makes the Irish famine so frustrating is the hypocrisy of everything, right? They are trying to say, so here's the other thing. Robert Peel's government, Peel is really kind of the, Peel is radically different than the rest of the Tory or conservative government of the time of which he's the head. The conservative government in the UK at this time believes in protectionism and mercantilism. They are not capitalists yet. The capitalist party are the Whigs or the Liberals. So at the time, actually, the conservatives believed that these tariffs, this protectionist tariff on farming goods in the UK, they believed that it was necessary to keep the corn laws in place because it kept the English economy going forward. And because the economy was so tied to the social hierarchy of the UK at the time, they believed that the corn laws also kept social order in place.
So it's almost like you have an extraction economy, which is taking everything out of Ireland. And then you have the corn laws, which are artificially inflating something that doesn't need to be artificially inflated.
Yes.
So you're basically, it's almost like a bubble, right? Because you're
depleting
something and you're making it more expensive without realizing kind of the ramifications on your own infrastructure.
And so it is 100% a bubble, right? Uh-huh. What's happening is the landowners, the people who own these large farms, they are continuing to get richer and richer because they're able to keep the price of corn or whatever high, even though the costs of labor are going down with industrialization, with everything else, and the economy slumping. At the same time, because the price of grains within the UK is kept artificially high by the corn laws, average consumers are getting screwed because now you're getting paid less than it costs to buy the grain you farm to feed your family.
Right. And this is in the UK for a certain population as well as
Ireland,
right.
Now, the particular problem with Ireland was, again, because, again, all of the UK had these problems, right? Scotland had these problems, you know, areas like everywhere in the UK had these problems. What made Ireland so particularly hard hit was the amount of land owned by large landowners was way out of whack with the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Way more land was owned by fewer people in Ireland than in other parts of the UK. And because the Irish were, because again, the trade that's coming, the trade between Ireland and the UK is one-sided. Trade is leaving Ireland. Right. Goods are leaving Ireland for the UK. Whereas in the UK, stuff is coming from all the other colonies, all the other places, which is fine.
Yes, but it's still being marked up.
Yes, yeah, it's still being marked up, but still, there's at least, like, variety. There's a little bit of marketplace happening there.
Right. You have options. It's limited and expensive versus Ireland that's got jack shit.
Exactly. It's a really weird thing, right? So the corn laws, they completely go against the tenets of laissez-faire capitalism.
But we were so, but we had, what's his bucket? Adam Smith.
Well, right? So here's the thing.
We were all down with laissez-faire.
Here's the thing.
No. We've hitched our wagon to laissez-faire.
Peel's government, or Peel himself and the Whigs, argue that the corn laws are standing in the way of Britain taking its place at the forefront of industrial capitalism. They argue that the corn laws are stopping Britain from being able to take her rightful place at the head of the world. And so Peel basically argues for the repeal of the corn laws again and again and again. He argues for them consistently that they should be gone. And the famine finally gives him kind of the background with which he can do it. So the famine is now bad. The famine is real bad. And so Peel's government says, all right, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to repeal the corn laws and we're going to set up a relief commission that'll have significant investments of public money to purchase food for those sectors most heavily damaged. And then because the corn laws are gone, the marketplace will fix the other areas that are having, they're being hit the hardest. But his cabinet, again, his cabinet is conservative. He is the head of the conservative government. So his cabinet completely rebels against this idea. They're saying that, well, okay, number one, repealing the corn laws will destroy British life. It'll destroy the British social hierarchy and really mess up all your friends' great lives, Peel. So don't do that, right? And they thought that purchasing food with government money would basically, again, create a system where people were stuck on getting relief from the government. They thought that's not the answer. Charity should step in and fix this, but it's not the government's job to get rid of poverty. Right? They think poverty is just a thing, you know?
So it's just natural position, you know, position again, of those drunken, that drunken subset of bottom feeders.
Now here's the thing. The corn law was already super unpopular in some circles, right? Capitalists at the time, they think the corn law is really bad government. It's bad economic policy. And there's some good reasons to think that that's probably true, right? They really had, I think, a pretty good case. The issue is that the corn law, like anti-corn law sentiment, was also kind of tied up with like almost utopian like fantasy, right? They thought that like the capitalist society would be the perfect society and all this other crap and whatever. So mixing the corn law question with the question of how to help the Irish, it really just kind of creates cover for these landowners to say, you know, to not just have to say outright, we're unwilling to help the poor. Now they can say, repealing the corn law will destroy the British world. You know, it allows them to have kind of a red herring to point to.
Yeah, well, it allows them to keep a bubble going, right? Because they can just keep all these things inflated. They don't ever have to come down from it or help, right? Or distribute, like they were saying, like if you're going to actually bring this stuff down, it's going to affect the landowners.
Yes, exactly. So you end up with and this is kind of the central issue and really like the central circle that happens of argument with the famine. You have, on the one hand, people arguing that we cannot harm British merchants by lowering prices and taking a capitalist approach. But on the other hand, we can't purchase food with government money because that goes against capitalism and will destroy the country.
But I mean, it's a catch-22 because really an artificial bubble is against capitalism.
Listen, it's all against it up,
right?
It's all against capitalism. It's crazy.
It's not the invisible hand of the market if you're making it do something, if you're making it cost more.
No, your hand is on the scale.
Your hand is on the scale. But then I would almost say that it is that charity or giving or making out or having the government buy food for the people is at least more of a capitalist because a capitalist venture, because at least they would still be buying something at a competitive rate hypothetically.
Well, all right. We are going to get into this after the break.
Ugh, capitalism.
Speaking of crony capitalism.
Speaking of crony capitalism, now a word from our sponsor.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. All right. Marie, you have hit on the third rail of the Irish famine government policy at the time. You would have been a great social critic in 1845 to 1850.
Well, I wouldn't have been able to read or own land.
That's a good point. Sorry.
Yeah, and I probably would be dead by now. So, yeah. But other than those things, it would have been super.
Super. You have, if you think about it, right, just think about it logically. There are two main methods of stopping a famine from decimating a population with starvation. First, you can have government intervention in the marketplace, right? Like, you can have the government buy food, you can have relief programs or housing or whatever, different ways to, like, feed the people. So you can either give them direct food and shelter, or you can give them jobs through which they can then purchase food.
Yeah, you can put them.
That's one option.
Yeah.
Another option is you can open up the marketplace to cheaper imports of food. So you make it more attractive to import food into the UK.
Mm-hmm.
You lower trade barriers that already exist. Mm-hmm. You invest in more ships or something, right? There's options, again, that the government can take to either solve this in a way that is more government direct intervention or government helping the market intervene.
Yeah, you pay for people to grow and sell different crops.
Here's the problem. The corn laws make either option either ineffective or outright impossible. And the holdover, like the hangover from the corn laws, mixed with this belief in the angel of capitalism, will make it impossible. Like, nothing will work. So think about this, right? Importing corn from cheaper regions, it's argued, would destroy the UK economy. So it's going to further plunge a country already undergoing economic hardship due to the blight in a further disarray. So essentially, they're arguing the one part of the economy that's doing good is the sale of grain right now. And you want to F that up? And so you're going to turn a country that has 50% starvation into a country that has 100% starvation? What are you, a communist? That's crazy. That'll never work. Right? American flags for everybody. On the other hand, they argue, using government means to provide relief to the public, that won't even be effective if the cost of grains is kept high by the corn laws. Right? So if you are working on a relief project, it becomes impossibly expensive if the government is required to pay high prices for corn because of a law that the government themselves made.
Yeah, you see, this is why this isn't going to work. This isn't going to end well.
So this actually, it's great. Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. So Peel, Sir Robert Peel, again, the prime minister at the time, he has to order a secret purchase of corn from America for distribution in Ireland to try to help them. Okay, he does it in secret. He orders 100,000 pounds worth of corn, so British pounds worth of corn from the Americas.
Oof, can you imagine if that would have gotten out? They would have drawn and quartered them, right? Well, that would have been like treason almost, right?
Well,
he's buying it from America to give to Ireland.
It does, so it does come out. And here's the thing, right? He also, it's funny actually. So importing corn is like one option, right? Like literally importing corn. Here's the problem though. Most of the Irish have never seen corn before. They don't know how to cook it. They don't know what to do with it. And the corn they're importing, like, if you have corn today, corn is not exactly the easiest thing to digest.
This is true.
And the corn at the time was even less processed and, like, genetically modified to be good for you than the corn of today. So they're sending corn to Ireland, and the Irish are like, what the fuck do we do with these yellow rocks? Yeah. How are we supposed to eat these?
Yeah, because they don't even have the process to mill them.
No.
They have none of the infrastructure to actually to manufacture or produce anything out of corn.
Exactly. There's no corn milling operations going on. They have no way of eating the corn that's being given to them in the first place. And so you end up having, like, stories of Irish peasants refusing to eat corn because they're like, that gives me diarrhea real bad.
Could they feed it to the livestock? I mean, isn't that something that they could then feed to
the cows and cattle? They could, in theory, feed it to the livestock if the livestock had not already been fucking
murdered.
They're
already all dead, right?
Yeah, they're already eaten. Yeah.
All right, so there's nothing. They got nothing.
Nothing. So you end up with, now... So now this is November, by the way. We've only gone through 1 month. November comes along, and the real scope of everything comes into stark terms.
Right.
They're reporting at least a third potato loss in basically every region of the UK, and areas of Ireland are like 50 and upwards. There is not enough food to feed the people at all. And so... finally, on the 20th of November, Peel will put together the first relief commission for Ireland particularly. And eventually, he will, by using the works or working alongside with the Whigs, will be able to push for the Corn Laws repeal. Now, the first time he pushes for it happens in December. It doesn't work, and he resigns as Prime Minister. And the opposition party leader, Lord John Russell, is not able to form a working government. So the Queen is like, too bad, try again. And hands it back to Peel.
Can you imagine how bad that must be?
Like, yeah,
like, you're crazy. Basically like, I can't do anything. I have to step down. Like, this is the worst situation that anyone could be in. And I'm just done with it. I'm done with fighting with it. I've done as much as I can. Let's let this other guy. And the other guy's like, nope, I'm unable to form a working government. So he has to be reinstated. There's no other option.
Yeah. And then the Queen is like, no, you can't do that. You must continue.
We are not amused.
Well, we'll feed you to the corgis.
Sir Peel, we will need you to return. Sorry, we need to. Just okay. Anyways.
Look at my son. His jaw isn't even attached to the rest of his skull because of the inbreeding. So, 1846. Now we're in 1846. January of 1846, the first reports of death start to come in. And they're bad. They're real bad.
And so it's only 3 months. It's only like since
it's only been 3 months.
They've said, hey, it could get bad. It is 3 months later, but they're like, yeah, it's bad. And here's the bodies.
It's now real bad.
That is bad.
Russell's Whigs are now also, because again, they are, they're raring to go, right? They had a shot at power and they effed it up. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we're going to get our stuff together. We're coming back. So finally, Russell and the Whigs will be able to repeal the Corn Laws in 1846. They're finally able to repeal them. Now, on top of repealing the Corn Laws, relief commissions are creating public works projects that are going to help. The thought is they're going to help the Irish in two ways. Number one, the Irish will be building infrastructure needed in the country. And number two, they're going to get paid for their work in a fair wage. And then they'll be able to buy grain or whatever other foodstuffs they can get in their local area.
Yeah, which was later used in America.
Two problems with that. Number one, there's no food to buy in Ireland. That's problem one. Okay. Problem two, no one is in charge of these goddamn works projects. They're building roads literally that don't connect to each other. They're just building shit in like fucking nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. There is no rhyme or reason to the relief efforts. Things are so bad, they're like, just have people doing something that we can pay them for.
Why do you think they were so bad? I'm looking at this, you know, the study, the work that we've done in the notes and everything. And I'm really curious, like, do you think that they were just, the British were so unfamiliar with aid and support?
Well,
that they weren't able to establish that. And they were so used to an extraction economy. They were so used to like not having to deal with stuff that the minute they had to deal with stuff, they were inept. I mean, that's like a terrible way of saying it, but I'm like, cause I mean, building roads, like public relief and public works on that level are pretty, you know, you would think even again, like I'm air quoting with the unskilled labor and people that are, you know, you're dealing with, starvation and poverty there, but you might have a shot at building some roads. And that didn't even pan out.
So it's interesting. There's kind of three main problems going on all at once. The first one is, it's like if we were in charge, like if we had to.
Oh, well, you're screwed right there then.
Okay, not us. Not like.
No, we can use we. We can use these. We can use these the royal we.
These are people who have never been to Ireland.
Mm.
So they are designing projects to be done on what it might as well be another planet with people that are starving to death, who don't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like there's a lot of reasons why it didn't work, mm-hmm. but I honestly think one of them is just like, in the best of times, this would have been a nearly impossible task, mm-hmm. I think, to have done from another country, you know.
That was my next question, is like, do you think that these would have worked better if they would have acknowledged the problem like a year earlier?
Well, here's the thing.
Because they had the government, right? They had the shared government there for a very brief amount of time.
At the beginning of the famine, Scotland was also in dire straits.
Right.
But these relief efforts worked in Scotland. I think because, or at least, you know, Scotland also was hit less badly than mm-hmm. Ireland and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly think it's, Scotland is geographically connected to the rest of the UK. And so there already were like roads to go to, right? Like there were already roads that connected Edinburgh, say, and you know what I mean? So like,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a continuity of sort of language. It's a continuity of land, literally. And it's easier to administer something when you're there, and right?
Scotland was more industrialized.
Exactly.
Okay.
Ireland, they're like creating roads in the middle of green fields, right? These are brand new construction projects. The other problem is, honestly, anti-Irish sentiment in the government. Just because Peel wanted these projects to work did not mean the people leading the efforts wanted them to work. A lot of the people in the Conservative government under Peel thought that these were wasteful, insane ideas, and they actively worked to make them fail. And we're going to see that again with, like, the main villain of the Irish famine, Charles Trevelyan. Right? Trevelyan wasn't, like, a huge government. He was an assistant secretary of the treasury. All right? He was in charge of Irish famine relief, and he actively thought that helping the Irish with famine relief was a bad idea. You know, so it's kind of like, you know, putting, it's like what we just saw in the United States, right? If you put somebody in charge of the post office whose job full time it is to destroy the post office, that's probably not going to go super great.
I was going to say, it's like putting John Bolton in as Secretary of State to deal with the UN when he had been originally talking about dismantling the UN.
Yeah, it's not a great call. The other thing,
it's not going to be super productive in a good way.
The other thing I think really is that, again, in other areas, like you said, there were also... It's the landlords. The landlords mm-hmm. also make up a big part of the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we get deeper in here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also that, again, the landlords don't believe that the corn law should be repealed. And so, again, they think that these sorts of public works projects or whatever, they think that they have to be destroyed. This is speculation. By the way, this is speculation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's really the break with the conservative government that makes the corn law repeal possible. It's hard to know why these efforts did not work effectively, fully.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I will say is that these early efforts are more effective than later efforts by far.
Mm.
And so, ultimately what ends up happening, the Peel government is able to repeal the corn laws in 1846, but that break with his party and the embrace of the Whigs means that he must resign by June 29th.
Finally, he gets to resign.
He does get to resign. Now, you might think, given everything we've talked about in this episode, that the repeal of the corn laws would mean better conditions for the Irish. But actually, it leads to much worse policies under the laissez-faire government efforts of the Lord John Russell.
Who's the dude who couldn't get it together early on.
Yes. Yes, he is. So, Russell takes over, like I said, in 1846. Basically, at this point now, because efforts at relief had not been working, but seemed to have worked okay in Scotland, and in other parts of the United Kingdom, the view of the Russell government and most government ministers is that these private works projects, which at this point, by the way, they're employing 71,000 different people daily. Basically, their idea is that this isn't working because the Irish are impossible to govern. It's the Irish fault.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Russell government decides, well, this relief isn't working. We're going to shut down all relief efforts and let the market take over. Now, the person put in charge of shutting down these efforts is the Treasury, led by Trevelyan.
Which, I mean, makes sense.
Yes.
Right? If you're going to be shutting something down monetarily, you would put the person in charge of the money would be, or a person in charge of the money would be good.
Now, the idea here is that they're going to shut down these public works projects that aren't working.
Mm-hmm.
And they are instead going to begin creating relief efforts that require the landlords and other taxpayers in country to be responsible for the relief of the poor.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh, but that's really not going to, that's not going to happen.
No, it's stupid
as
shit. That's
like, that it's, what's so funny is, again, not to get political, but oh well, it is so close to what happens recently, right? Where we give up with COVID relief, right? So we can't handle it from a national, or we don't want to handle it from a national level because we're going to screw it up so badly. So we're just going to let each state buy their own PPE.
It's crazy.
Right? Yeah, right? We're gonna let them all fight it out and take and decides what's best.
So which
never works. It never works because you're fighting against one another, and you're not getting people what they need, and you're letting the people on the top off the hook for making the big decisions that you are paying them with your tax dollars to make. Amazing. Amazing.
It's crazy.
I'm so glad that we've learned so much from our past. Keep going.
It's crazy.
I'm just going to sit over here and chew on some glass.
So again, in December of 45, December of 1845, Peel puts in his first resignation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then finally, the government is taken over by Russell. In January, though, of 46, Charles Trevelyan becomes the really kind of important figure here in this. He is the permanent secretary at the Treasury. And so his role really is to basically kind of fight back against but he's one of those executive functionaries in government whose role it is to make sure that, like, the Treasury, the economy is taken care of, right? Mm-hmm. But now here's a quote from him. So he says, quote, "Indirect permanent advantages will accrue to Ireland from the scarcity and the measures taken for its relief. Besides, the greatest improvement of all that could take place in Ireland would be to teach the people to depend upon themselves for developing the resources of the country instead of having recourse to the assistance of the government on every occasion." End quote.
God, what a dick.
Now, Indian corn finally makes its way to Ireland in February of 46. Remember how before I said that they got diarrhea from eating it?
Yeah.
They actually called it Peel's Brimstone.
Ah!
Which is hilarious.
That is pretty funny.
But again, so they basically take over and they say these efforts to help people should be stopped. Right. Now, there were different efforts at the time, right? There were food depots, mm-hmm. there were these public works projects, there were these other mm-hmm. things. But essentially, they decide by August, the green depots are going to be closed. The public works projects have to be stopped. And the ratepayers, the taxpayers of Ireland, should be the ones to take over the burden of paying for Irish relief. Mm-hmm. So some of these start to be mm-hmm. things like, basically the government goes around to the rich and starts asking them for donations. Mm-hmm. And the rich are like, why would I do that?
Yeah, no. Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. They do not want to do that.
Huh. Well, they've never been incentivized to help, right?
Exactly. I mean,
that's the other thing. It's like there's been no impetus to give back anything. So why would they start now?
And that's where we're going to end this episode. Next episode, we'll get into the beginnings of the Russell government and really see why people don't think of this as just another natural disaster. They think of this as, in the most charitable viewing, an example of horrible government management of a crisis. And in the least charitable view towards the British government, an active genocide of the peoples of Ireland, and an attempt really to rid the United Kingdom of peoples that the government at the time believed were just a burden. And so next episode, we'll pick up with the Russell government in the years 1846 to the end of the Irish famine.
Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at madscientistpod or at Team Giant Squid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard.
Woohoo!
And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
Hey there. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema.
Our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.